Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. And we're pleased to have back here on the program this morning, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at U of I in the med school here at Urbana-Champaign. She also has a practice, a private practice here in Champaign-Urbana. And for a long time, she's been a regular guest on the program to talk about women's health. We do this show now every other month. It's always on a Monday, and give people the opportunity to call in and ask questions. Now, she comes prepared and is prepared to talk about a few things that are new, and we will do that. However, it's also here, she is here to be a resource for you as well. And if you have questions, we'd certainly welcome them. Whenever we have doctors on the program, I also try to remind people that we cannot do diagnosis over the phone because the doctor cannot see you. So if you have a real concern, you want to pursue that with someone that you can talk to and who can see you. But this is also a place that you can start, maybe ask some basic questions, get some basic knowledge on health, particularly those areas in which she works. And that's fine. That's why we do these shows. So questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. Thank you very much for being here again. I appreciate it.
Good morning.
So what would you like to talk about here to start out with?
Well, the National Osteoporosis Foundation just issued its new guidelines for how we should evaluate, diagnose, and treat women and men over the age of 50 with osteoporosis. And I think that it bears some reviewing because it's a little bit different set of guidelines than what we've used before. And like other recommendations, mammography has been the most notable. You and I have probably discussed over the last 15 years where we had all different organizations telling us when to do mammograms and how often, when to start and so forth. And now we've finally gotten those organizations together with mammography. We're still somewhat in that step with osteoporosis testing and treatment where the American College of Clinical Endocrinologists and the Radiology Society and the gynecologists and the National Osteoporosis Foundation and various menopause groups like the North American Menopause Association, which is the largest group of menopause practitioners in the country, they were all giving clinicians and patients different advice as to when to get your bones density tested and then when to treat based on those scores. So there's been a lot of confusion, but I think that these new guidelines will really help end some of that confusion and be useful for patients as well. So they have a very good website, and I know I've referenced it before. It's NOF.org for National Osteoporosis Foundation, and then you have to click around a little bit to get to the tool that I use, but you can actually, you yourself as a patient, get to the tool if you would want. And it's called a fracture risk assessment, and I think they use the initials FRAX. And it's actually also available at the World Health Organization. And it's a tool that they've tried to put some of the major factors in. So whether you're male, whether you're female, your height and weight, your whether you've had a fracture, your family history of fractures, and something about a bone density test. Now, I should caution patients that are doing, if they're going to try to give themselves a score, they should read the instructions pretty well because a bone test like on a heel wouldn't count. It's a peripheral measurement. Mm-hmm. And the peripheral measurements, it's not that they're not useful at all. They are, but those measurements haven't been correlated with fracture risk. And so all our guidelines now don't really have so much to do with what your absolute score is, but how likely you are to have a fracture over the next 10 years. So if you're 50, we're looking at this, how likely you are to have a fracture over these next 10 years. But obviously in your mind, you then have to say, okay, I'm gonna live a lot longer than 50 because the average healthy 50-year-old probably going to get darn near close to 100, or many of them are anyway. We already have over 50,000 women in the United States today over the age of 100. That's a lot.
Yeah,
it is a lot. And so with this fracture risk assessment tool, like other tools, it really should be interpreted by your own provider because, for instance, it minimizes people that have many fractures. So you just say yes or no to whether or not you've had a fracture. But if you've actually had several fractures, it's going to calculate your same risk as compared to somebody that's really only had one, whereas your physician might interpret that a little bit differently, depending on what the reasons were for your fractures, of course. And we think that with this tool, we estimate what a person's fracture risk of getting a major hip fracture, which is the most significant osteoporotic fracture there is, over the next 10 years, and the risk of any osteoporotic fracture over the next 10 years, where we say you should think about treatment if your hip fracture risk over the next 10 years is greater than 2%, and 3%, and the overall osteoporotic fracture rate is greater than 20%. So it's a little bit different. We've in the past spent a lot of time talking about absolute numbers. If you are greater than minus 1.5, you're only in an osteopenic range, but that generally would translate into treatment and some of the other guidelines. And definitely all the osteoporotic patients who are greater than or equal to minus 2.5 standard deviations from the mean on your bone density test, those are scores you get if you get your bones tested. Those patients have been tracked into treatment. But actually in this new system, some patients that would have been tracked for medication aren't going to be. Now, if you're not going to be tracked for medication, you still have to do things that are good for your bone health. And their guidelines also make a big point to have your clinicians check you for what's called secondary causes. So not just that you're aging or you're going through menopause, but it's something else going on. And really, it's very difficult to check for that if you've had zero lab work. So if you've never had your calcium measured, never had urinary markers measured, you might be somebody with secondary osteoporosis, and you might not have that diagnosis yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, having said that, there are different ideas about bone density testing, about who and when and how. Tell me what you think about who and when and how. Like at what age should it be? Should both men and women get it? And then, you know, given the fact that there are easier ways or tougher ways, and you want to get the best information that you can, and that may mean more than just checking somebody's little finger to see what's going on there. How do you do it?
So the best tests are what we call central measurements, and that's on your spine and in the hip region. And the newer machines do check for both hips, and the newer machines also check L1 through L4, so lumbar vertebra 1 through 4. Also, the better machines do what we call VFA. You know, in medicine, we have an initial for everything. And VFA stands for vertebral fracture analysis. So you actually, when you're doing a bone density test, you're laying on your back, you're getting your spine and your hips scanned, but for vertebral fracture analysis, you're flipping someone on their side and you're looking at the actual shape of the vertebra and looking for compression, because air can be introduced in the spinal measurement, because if you're so fractured that your spinal column is compressed, it will measure as very dense, but it's all packed in there and it's not a normal structure whatsoever. So getting a central measurement is the best. And when to get that, I think ideally over the age of 50 for all women and 70 or older for all men, unless you have risk factors. And they came out with their recommendations for risk factors. And they've got actually about 3 pages of potential risk factors, and whether you've had previous fractures and family history and your calcium intake and some other things does factor into that. Inactivity, high caffeine intake. There's many people that that do contribute to their osteoporosis by high caffeine intake. Alcohol, it has to be 3 or more drinks a day, since that would be significant. Genetic disorders like cystic fibrosis, not so common in our population, but more common than we thought now that we test. We have a whole list of fairly complicated endocrine disorders that most people would know about. But gastrointestinal disease, if you've had GI tract surgery before, or if you have inflammatory bowel disease, that may be a reason you're not absorbing your calcium well and that you should get tested. And so there are many other factors. Of course, with these tests, an issue has always been cost. It's not so much if the radiation exposure is almost zip. And so it's not a question of whether the test is risky or painful in any way. It's to some extent a question of cost. And there are some insurance plans that won't pay for testing of younger patients. And there are some insurance companies that will. But with the, again, working with your physician, really going carefully over your risk factors and coding for that properly might help coax your insurance plan into getting a measurement. And for people with health savings accounts, I think it's a very useful way to decide whether or not to go on medication.
So the test that we're talking about is an X-ray?
It's actually an X-ray. You lay on a table and they use a pencil-shaped beam in one direction and another direction, and they are comparing you to a standard sort of a box. And we talk about the density of your bones. And when you took physics, you probably learned that that was a volume thing, density. But when we give you a score, we're tricking you and giving you in grams per centimeter square, which if you remembered physics is an area measurement. So you're going to say, wait a minute. And I said that too when I was learning about these tests. But actually they put in a computer calculation of the third dimension, figuring that the bones don't grow after a certain point. So the computer, it's doing a 2D measurement and calculation based on the 2D. And that's the way it is done. And the amount of radiation, if the technician was in the room doing X-rays on these bone densities all day long, all year long, they would probably barely get the amount of radiation exposure that they would get spending outdoors all day. It's that little.
Okay.
So it's really amazing technology, and they get a lot of information. My bone density machine actually does body fat analysis as well. You can, with these, do a calculation based on your overall measurements and how much is bone and how much is fat to get a body fat percent too. Help you with your diet a little bit if you wanted to do that.
Okay. Well, let me ask you one other question. For most people, for your average person, what you can do to try to make sure you have healthy bones is to make sure you're taking in enough calcium, and you also need to have vitamin D, and you need to have some weight-bearing exercise.
Correct.
Past that, what?
Well, avoid alcohol, avoid smoking, and watch what medications you're on. Certain medications are negative for bones. So, for instance, anyone on steroids for 3 months or longer is recommended to have medication to combat the effects of those steroids. So you really need to keep in good communication with your provider regarding what medicines you're starting and how long you're taking them. But the other interesting thing is when you say adequate calcium, of course, the next follow-up question is how much calcium is that going to be? And we have said prior to menopause, 800 milligrams a day. After menopause, 1,000 milligrams a day. If you're osteopenic or osteoporotic, most physicians jump that up to 1,200 to 1,500 a day. And yet there was a new study that has just identified for us called the calcium paradox. And the calcium paradox is that too much calcium or higher amounts of calcium have now been, in older women, been associated with actual increased risk of myocardial infarction, even though the people that had the higher levels of calcium intake actually had better cholesterol profiles. So if you have better cholesterol, you're supposed to have fewer incidences of cardiovascular disease. So they've started looking into this. And what seems to happen with older patients is that as their bones weaken, their calcium leaches from their bones into their bloodstream. And then from the bloodstream, some of this calcium gets incorporated up into the plaques of the cholesterol plaques, the arteriosclerosis that we develop in part from nutrition, in part from aging, in part from our genetics. And with increased calcium intake to balance some of that off, apparently when we get up to high levels of calcium intake, some of that cholesterol is then additionally deposited into those plaques, and that raises the risk of myocardial infarction. So again, it is interesting to learn about these health issues and to understand what questions to ask your own healthcare provider, but sometimes it takes a lot of finesse to sort out all these factors and decide, okay, which group are you in? Are you in a group that needs a lot of extra calcium, a little extra calcium, something else to go on to counterbalance the effects of calcium? And we're learning that some of the negatives can always be counterbalanced. We talked a lot about the effect of alcohol on breast cancer, for instance. And it turns out that if you take in a proper amount of folic acid, it actually completely negates the effects of alcohol on breast cancer risk, at least in epidemiologic studies. So a lot of it has to do with weighing out, in your case, what you individually need to do. For instance, the weight-bearing exercise, well, you need a certain amount of exercise to increase your heart rate and get in shape. And weight-bearing is better than non-weight-bearing for your bones. But if you've got advanced osteoarthritis or other conditions that would make weight-bearing exercise detrimental to your joints, then you need to do non-weight-bearing exercise, and that is definitely better than being sedentary in terms of your bones. Mm.
And just as far as calcium intake is concerned, I know that when it comes to things like that, nutritionists would say, we would really prefer that you get this in your diet.
Correct.
Rather than taking a pill. But there might be some people, for whatever reason, maybe they can't, you know, the main thing, I guess, the main way is with dairy products. There are foods that have calcium in them, but you can only eat so much broccoli, you know. So there might be people who say, I don't think that I can get enough just through my diet. Is it okay to take a supplement?
Absolutely. And again, here's where we can actually use blood tests if there's a problem or a problem with supplements. Even supplements can be fairly constipating. So sometimes it takes meeting with your clinic and really figuring out how much calcium you're getting in your food. Most people don't remember that a potato has 60 of calcium in it. So, you know, there are foods that aren't traditionally your calcium-rich foods that have quite a bit of calcium. So during the day, you may be getting more calcium intake than you think. And of course, so many foods now are supplemented with both calcium and even vitamin D.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's something we've talked about, that there now is some concern that maybe all of us are not getting as much vitamin D as we should. And that's good just for general principles. There are probably a lot of good things that vitamin D does, but it is important in calcium, in getting the calcium incorporated in your bones.
You pretty much need vitamin D to get that calcium from your diet into your bloodstream where it can get into bones. And absolutely, most of what I've seen about vitamin D is quite positive, and even there was one study saying that vitamin D is a longevity booster. So that was a good one. They said it reduced all-cause mortality by 7% during 5.5 years of follow-up, which just seems amazing to me. But the more I read about vitamin D, the more positive. And of course, the author that was writing what I read most recently said, well, we've been wrong on many vitamins before. So it turns out that, you know, we might have some things to learn that we were saying about vitamin D. But they were saying that in this particular case that they actually had pretty good scientific evidence that they took patients that were having the most vitamin D intake and they specifically looked at their DNA and whether or not their chromosomes were very intact or whether their chromosome pattern on random samples of their DNA were more fractured, and fractured chromosomes cannot repair tissues the way they're supposed to. And in fact, intake of vitamin D was correlated with how these chromosomes look. So more vitamin D, healthier chromosomes, live longer.
Right. And what is the recommended amount of vitamin D?
Well, again, we used to say 400, and most of us are up in the 800 to 1,000. It's international units. Vitamin D doesn't come as milligrams. It's in international units. And probably the natural sources of vitamin D are a little bit better, but I would say don't worry about that too much. Whatever you're buying in your vitamin D product is good. And many calcium supplements now are fortified with D. Yeah. So you just need to read the labels.
Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist with a women's health practice in Champaign. She's also clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. And every other month on a Monday, she's here. We talk about women's health. And if you have questions about this particular subject or anything else that's in her area of practice, give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455.
Well, you know, everything you pick up in the magazines say that we are a population that has been gaining weight, and there have been some very interesting new studies regarding weight loss management, both with medicine and non-medicine. And one group has come up with a device that makes you chew slower. You could do it yourself, obviously. So they're calling it an oral speed bump. They've devised a device where it's not physically possible to chew fast, and patients lost up to 5% of their weight in a 6-month period of time just by not eating fast.
What does that do for you, eating more slowly?
I think you probably eat less.
Oh, okay. Well, that would make sense. So that's just that simple. And there's nothing magical about this.
Correct.
It's just that you end up eating less.
Right.
All right. Well, that's fine. Questions welcome. In fact, we've got a couple here. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone over in Vermilion County to start us off. Line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hi, back to vitamin D. I'd like to know what the mechanism is. Is it the skin that absorbs it, and also the effect on mood? Is light hitting the retina? How does the intake of it work?
Well, the UVB rays on the skin do convert precursors into the active vitamin D, which is how it works that we get that from the sun. It doesn't really have anything to do with our retina per se. That would be our skin. And they say that in southern climates, that even exposures as short as 15 to 30 minutes a day in bright sunlight, you could probably convert a significant percentage of your vitamin D. But in northern climates, we would need much longer. And, you know, in the winter, that doesn't really work out. But it mechanistically works by helping calcium go across our GI tract and be absorbed up into our system. So it's not really vitamin D that's directly affecting our bone. Exactly what vitamin D has to do with the moods, we don't know exactly, but light and mood probably has something to do with serotonin levels.
So we do get some vitamin D by being out in the sun.
Oh, absolutely.
But we still have to.
I should modify that comment, though.
Yes.
They have shown that the older we get, the less efficiently our skin does that conversion. But still, the average younger person would get quite a bit. And when your skin starts to do that less effectively, probably over the age of 65.
How much the proportion of vitamin D that you get from sun exposure and that you get in your diet? How do you know, sort of offhand, how much is each accounts for?
Well, I think that if you were a sun worshiper in the South, you probably could get all you need by the sun when you're young. But basically, for most Northerners, just figure you're getting zero. Yeah.
Of course, now the dermatologists say that we should be wearing sunscreen that blocks out UV A and B.
It does. And therefore, the dermatologists have pretty much said that supplementation is the way to go.
All right. So we're not really going to be able to get it that way. We're going to have to make sure that we get in our diet. And if we're not eating enough calcium-rich foods, well, then we're going to have to take a pill.
Right.
All right. Couple of callers here in Bloomington. We'll start first with line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm concerned about taking a supplement or a medicine, Actonel. My doctor tried to get me for 3 years to take this, and he said if I didn't take it, I would have osteoporosis. Years ago, I went to a nutritionist in Peoria that did a hair analysis, which I know probably isn't very dependable, but she said I had too much calcium in my system, and the last thing she would ever do was put more calcium in my system. So I've always been afraid to take extra calcium. Now he's got me on this Actonel, and I'm worried about it. I'm worried about the dental health and all the side effects. I just don't know if it's a thing to do or if I should do something else.
Actonel is a bisphosphonate. It's a medication. It's not a supplement. It is a medication that will actually pull calcium from your bloodstream into your bones. And it has been shown to be both preventative against osteoporosis and preventative against fractures for those who have osteoporosis. And it is important with any bisphosphonate to take in an adequate amount of calcium, because if you don't take an adequate amount of calcium in while you're taking your Actonel, you're both at risk for the medicine not to work properly. And probably not likely, but it's possible for your calcium levels to go too low, because that medicine's going to send your calcium into your bones. And hair analysis can work, but it will vary over time. So a hair analysis done years ago might not be pertinent to what's going on now. And so most of us will recommend medication treatment of osteoporosis based on these new fracture prevention guidelines like I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's an excellent medicine. Oh, you mentioned the dental health.
Mm-hmm.
Every bisphosphonate has been shown to be associated with osteonecrosis of the jaw, but the rate is 1 in 10,000 cases, and there have been many large studies that actually had no patients that had that problem.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your answer.
Right, thank you. Let's continue. We'll talk next with someone else in Bloomington. This is line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
I'm calling because I have been diagnosed with osteoporosis, and I've been taking Fosamax for about 5 years now, and I thought it had gotten better in the middle, but it's back to now about two standard deviations below my age, and I'm just over 50. I recently, my doctor upped my calcium intake to 2,000 milligrams a day, and I wonder is it okay to take that 2,000 milligrams a day along with with my dietary calcium intake with like say 2 or 3 glasses of milk a day and with whatever comes in the food. And secondly, I also read that magnesium is very important for the absorption of calcium and for strengthening of the bones. Is that really true?
Okay, lots of good questions. I'm not sure I can get them all answered, but let me try. Yes, there are other things besides besides vitamin D that actually contribute to calcium and bone health. Magnesium is one. Vitamin K is one. They have shown some studies even with vitamin E and some studies with some of the minerals. It's very hard to be magnesium deficient. Our diets have a lot of magnesium in it, but there are now some calcium supplements that do come with some magnesium in them. And
if I can just ask a question, I'm also, you know, vegetarian. So I don't know if that makes a difference in the diet being, you know, magnesium sufficient.
Careful analysis of any vegetarian's diet really always has to be done to be sure you're hitting all the high spots. But most of the vegetarians that I take care of are really good about this and really have a very top-notch vegetarian diet. Unlike the meat eaters, we tend to be sloppier, I think. But most likely, you're probably still getting enough calcium, but you would probably need magnesium, but you probably would need a little bit of analysis. We think that most average healthy people can tolerate up to 4,000 of calcium per day. So you're definitely way under that, even though you are kind of bumping up the recommendations. It's also doctors and patients alike tend to, I believe, overinterpret those scores. So, and I've said this before, when we do research studies with all the medicines, and Fosamax is one of the bisphosphonates, when we do research studies on fracture prevention, and we look at patients on placebo, patients on medicine whose scores stay the same, patients on medicine whose scores drop, and patients on medicine whose scores actually improve, we actually show fracture protection in all those different medicine groups. So just because your score is dropping, you've got to remember, number one, it may have dropped more because the average menopausal patient would be, if she was off of medicine, would be losing 2-4% of her bone per year.
Okay. So yeah, I was actually off for about 6 months because I was actually undergoing treatment for you know, breast cancer. And then I had to have dental surgery. So in that process, I was off of Fosamax for about 6 months.
Well, they've actually done a couple of different studies apply to your questions. One, they've done one study after 5 years of time. They looked at bone health over 1 year. And actually, most patients maintained their effect well over 1 year. So being off of, after a 5-year course, being off of medicine for 6 months, generally for most patients is not a problem. But also what I was going to say is it's not just the score that's an issue. It's other factors. And the other factors have to do with the structure of the bone. And we know that these medicines help improve our bone structure. Now, that having been said, the thing that builds bone the best that's out there is parathyroid hormone. Now, right now, it's only available in an injectable, although an oral form was just approved by the FDA. And it's very expensive. It can only be given over 2 years at a time. And we generally reserve it for the more severe cases. But there are other medicines. Also, there was a odd study just published, and I literally was reading it this morning over my morning coffee with caffeine. I'll try to do extra weight-bearing exercises today. But a study looking specifically at a subset of patients on long-term Fosamax use over 5 years who actually had increased fracture risk, and they think that there's some patients who may have a slightly different physiology. And for what I usually generally say to my patients, like other doctors, we give these broad sweeping recommendations. And in general, it's the rare thing in medicine where we can really specifically target very small subsets of patients. But if I looked into my crystal ball a number of years down the line, we will be specifically looking at groups of patients that maybe have to be treated a little bit differently. Now, this doesn't help your case right in the minute, but I think that what you're talking about, a lot of sophisticated, good questions, and it's possible that an endocrinologist or somebody who does more intense work in the area of osteoporosis and osteoporosis prevention might be somebody good to consult at some point.
Okay, so it would be an endocrinologist because, okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll continue and take now someone in Champaign on line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if Dr. Turpin had read the research about cannabinoids being used to treat osteoporosis.
I did see something, but I didn't study it in depth. And I think the one study that was published was something about extracts that I don't think are available. So I didn't pay close attention to it. So I probably can't give you any specific answers.
But well, I do know that it does repair the bone, and the natural cannabinoids do not. You can't overdose on the natural cannabinoids. But what the Hebrew University in Israel has done is, well, they've patented compounds, analogs, while you can use the natural to heal osteoporosis.
Well,
and I don't know why it's illegal, the natural, in this state.
Yeah, I would have to look at that. And the other thing that I wanted to mention about osteoporosis, of course, I said that we're measuring these bone densities, and in most of these studies, we're not really getting at the true nature of bone healing. So that when we do research studies, we might even do a bone biopsy and determine this, and it may be one of the studies that you've done. Has helped determine it. But actually getting at structure has been something a little bit trickier. It's also a good idea for patients who are having problems with their osteoporosis treatment and maybe wondering about its effectiveness. There are good ways to measure whether or not the bone turnover is properly responding to the medicine. And those are blood tests and urine tests, and those are important. It's also very important for us to get measured in a machine that has the capability of comparing you to your own group. So our older machines, the computer numbers generated were based on Caucasian females. And now the newer machines have measurements for men and different ethnic groups, and that's very important when interpreting the results, no matter what medicine you're using.
Are you measuring methionine levels or homocysteine levels in your patients? Because I would think with high methionine diets, in meat eaters in particular, you would find higher rates of osteopenia.
And there's been a lot of argument about whether eating too much protein, and meat eaters generally eat more protein than the vegetarians, and whether or not that can be detrimental to your bone health, because in processing all that protein, some calcium goes out with it. So that's always been a little bit of a controversy. I use homocysteine measurements to really look more at cardiac health more than bone health.
Okay, thanks.
All right. We have about 15 minutes, well, maybe more like about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's on the program every other month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. She's an OBGYN. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here next, we have someone in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my question has to do with osteoporosis treatment also. Do you know anything about fluoride ever having been used or being
Oh,
used?
Yeah. Long history, actually. But and it can increase bone density, but it increases the brittleness of the bones and had some structure-related problems. So it really has always... What I've always read and been taught from the older studies was that you can use it, but it wasn't that the bone that we were generating was so healthy and that it was good for fracture prevention. Now, I actually read a study not too long ago, or an editorial by an expert, who said some of that older research wasn't very accurate, And we have such better measurements now that it could be something that could be revisited. But because that's the only research we have available, very few people are ever treated with fluoride. It would be something that we'd work our way down to. But now there's so many SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators, like Avista, and there are two or three others in development that I've worked with. Possibly using testosterone is going to be good. And as we do more studies on sexuality with testosterone, that may be a solution as well.
Okay. Then I am taking Avista and have been for several years. And that has a slightly different approach, does it, to a prevention or to treatment for osteopenia or osteoporosis? Is that right?
The bisphosphonates, estrogen, Avista, and calcitonin all work by slowing bone turnover down. Exactly how they do that and what receptors they bind to in bone cells varies very slightly, but their overall mechanism of how they improve your bone is quite similar in the respect that it slows bone turnover down, and that's why scores improve. You lose less, and then when you naturally build your bone back up, you have gains, versus parathyroid hormone or the medicine Forteo, which actually increases the it causes death of the cells that wear away bone, and so there's bone buildup.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for answering that.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call. Again, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have some questions here. We'll see how many we can get in the time that remains. I think we have another caller getting lined up on our toll free line in Greenup. They will be next. Line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
My internist told me to only take my Fosamax with distilled water. I live in the country and I drink well water. She believes that the well water is the reason the Fosamax hasn't worked as well with me.
Well, absorption problems can be an issue, and well water might indeed contain factors that would slightly disrupt the absorption, which is why we now have two different products, the Beneva medication and Reclass medication can both be given intravenously, although Beneva is only designed to be given four times a year and Reclass once a year. So you can get your bisphosphonate directly intravenously, and if you think that absorption is the problem, and they did a comparison study of Reclast and Fosamax specifically, so the IV versus the oral, and because the compliance with the IV is virtually 100%, you get your dose and you're done for the year, whereas oral compliance, even if you're very good at it, people tend to miss a dose. And if you're worried, the intravenous could be a solution.
I've been taking Fosamax for, I believe, 9 years. About how old is Fosamax?
Well, it's you were one of the early ones, but it's been around a little bit longer than that. And the company has published much data on patients taking it for 10 years, and I've seen data on patients taking it for even longer than that. So you're in the early group, but it has been around for
a while.
It does
build up in the system, doesn't it?
It will get
over all these years.
It will get incorporated into your bone. We don't think that it gets incorporated into any other structure of your body, which makes bisphosphonate such an ideal compound for treatment of bone disease.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And again, to someone here in Champaign, the next caller is on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering about phosphorus. I have bred dogs for a long time, and in dogs, they require calcium, vitamin D, and phosphorus to all be in a correct ratio in order for them to absorb calcium properly. And I've never seen a human calcium supplement that's included phosphorus. So I wondered if humans don't require it or...
Well, we tend to have too much in our food. We drink pop. And too much phosphorus can actually bind your calcium if you take it at the same time. But absolutely, you do need some. But it tends to be in our food.
Oh, okay. So in humans, they just assume that you're getting enough phosphorus to make the calcium work, and then you just need to make sure the vitamin D is there to
correct.
Also help the absorption.
Correct.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, if somebody wants to call real quick, I imagine we could get in a call. Otherwise, we will continue here to talk with Dr. Suzanne, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Okay, we have a couple minutes. We've been talking a lot about osteoporosis.
I know.
Is there something else you would really
like
to get to?
I was going to say, I'm doing one of my lectures on... I think Thursday evening in my office on backs and bone health and that sort of thing. So if somebody's interested, they could always call my office. I think we still have a few more spots, although I think I was going to talk a lot about a study that I've already filled, but I've got other things to talk about.
Okay.
Also, I want to talk about using intravenous iron as well. Many patients have a lot of difficulty with taking oral iron, and I've been involved in many research studies using intravenous iron products, and the FDA is giving the nod to go ahead with some of the newer intravenous irons as well. So again, for patients who take a lot of medicines, have stomach upset, have other reasons that they have absorption problems in their GI tract, there are many different medications now that can be delivered in different ways. With hormones, we look to transdermal. So when we're doing our sexuality studies with testosterone, it's a gel that's testosterone that we're using. And when we are trying to treat osteoporosis and anemia, it's intravenous, which it's a needle, and these medicines aren't always inexpensive, but they're great alternatives.
Okay. Another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was just calling to see if you could recommend a natural supplement for energy. I've kind of low energy levels, and I've increased my vitamin D intake, but I was wondering if you knew of sort of a natural supplement.
Well, there have been many studies that show that caffeine is definitely related to energy levels, and it's definitely found in natural products like coffee beans.
That's been my go-to one so far.
Caffeine is, and there are many studies to show caffeine benefits. Now, again, too much is too much, but there are studies that link caffeine intake to decreased gallstones, for instance. So not all caffeine intake is bad for you. Vitamin D is another one. Just getting enough iron and not being anemic. But for some patients, it takes more than just iron. They need a complex of B vitamins. And there have been studies over the years showing that B12 injections do help with energy levels. Some people call that sort of an old general practitioner doctor recommendation, but it is still an opportunity. But probably would take a little bit of evaluation by your healthcare provider, blood tests and so forth, to see if there's anything they can identify that metabolically you have an imbalance of, and then pulling that imbalance helps. Also, the big one in our population is proper sleep. A lot of people do not get proper sleep, even if they're physically in bed for a number of hours that they need. Many people aren't really truly getting their good sleep pattern, and getting that analyzed, again, not necessarily an inexpensive thing to do, but sometimes can be very helpful.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. How much of a problem is in women is anemia? And I wonder how many women might be kind of borderline anemic, maybe not enough to be textbook anemic, but enough
right.
for there to be an
low
effect.
Iron stores.
Yeah.
And we use ferritin measures, blood tests to check that. And it seems to be common. It's more common in women with heavy menstrual bleeding. And that's why if we use the newer treatments like ablation, or we use proper low-dose oral contraception and control heavy menstrual bleeding. For young women, that's the number one cause of anemia.
Mm, okay. Anything else you'd want to mention real quick?
Well, and as the other thing with anemia is anybody that bleeds a little bit heavily might have actual pre-existing blood disorders. They think that even subtle cases of von Willebrand's disease might be in 5 to 10% of the population of women that have heavy periods. So that's another thing that can be tested for. And there are about 4 different variants of von Willebrand's disease. And not all of it just has to do with whether or not you have good factor VIII levels. It has to do with whether or not your factor VIII functions the way it's supposed to. So some of the testing is a little bit sophisticated, and you almost need hematology consultation to really get at all these cases. But that's something else that we do look into.
All right. Well, there, we'll leave it for this time around with the promise that in 2 months, Suzanne will be back. We do this program on Women's Health every other month with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Fruppen. She is obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice. She's also clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The programming today is made possible by Parkland College Theater presenting the musical comedy Return to the Forbidden Planet from Wednesday, April 2nd through Saturday, April 19th. The starship Albatross is drawn to the mysterious planet Deliria, where a sci-fi version of The Tempest unfolds to rock and roll hits of the 50s and 60s. More information available at 351-2528. Tomorrow morning on the program, we'll be talking with David Levy. He's a science editor at Parade Magazine, president of the National Sharing the Sky Foundation. He'll be here giving a talk on the campus about Shakespeare as a sky watcher, joining astronomy with English literature. That's hour number one. And then hour two, we'll talk with Richard Florida. He's director of the Martin Prosperity Institute, professor of business and creativity at the University of Toronto, and someone who has written a lot about cities and what it is that makes cities vibrant and makes them thrive. And we'll talk about his most recent book titled Who is Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. That's tomorrow in hour two. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and we welcome your calls. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The show is hosted by Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. And coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, your host will be Jason Croft. The topic, rockabilly. Let's turn our attention now to the commodity markets in Kansas City. May wheat trading at 11.04, up 72. In Chicago, May wheat 10.55, up 67 and a half. July 10.48 and a quarter, up 61 and three quarters. May corn 5.21 and a quarter, up 13 and three quarters. July 5.33 and a quarter, up 14. September 5.36 and three quarters, up 13 and three quarters. December 5.34 and three quarters, up 13 and a half. May beans 12.54 and a half, up 47 and a half. July 12.68, up 46. August 12.58, up 42. November 11.51, up 11. May meal 3.26.30, up 16. July 3.29, up 14.50. May oil 55.28, up 88. July 55.95, up 81. At the market in Chicago, April live cattle 90.20, down 47 and a half. June 90.82 and a half, down 15. April feeder cattle 103.20, down 82 and a half. May 106.50, down 85. April lean hogs 56.15, down 17 and a half. Now to the outside markets, where May crude is trading at 101.25, down 59. The CRB index 383.94, down 436. The U.S. dollar 72.99, that is up 24. And the Dow, as of 15 minutes ago, was up 245 points. It's noon Central Time. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications.